Let's get right back into our story in 2 Kings chapter 5, verse number 20, talking about the foolish choice, the greedy foolish choice of Gehazi, the servant of Elisha the prophet, when Naaman, the leper from Syria, is cleansed by Elisha, and Elisha absolutely refuses to take anything of value from Naaman as a thank you gift. Now, Naaman came prepared to donate many tens of millions of dollars of material value, but he won't accept any. Elisha won't accept any of it. And Gehazi can't believe it. So when Naaman is already on the road heading back to Damascus, and it'll take him several days to get there, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, "See, my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian in not accepting from his hand what he brought." So it's like, I can't believe he let him get away with not giving him any of that stuff. "As he who lives, I will run after him and get something from him." So I'm going to fix this problem. I'm going to get some of that wealth for me to hold on to. Now, I'm guessing he may have excused his own greediness by saying that he would keep it, you know, on hand for use for Elisha later, or maybe the schools of the prophets. But it seems as if it's his greed that's driving this. We see people get their heads turned by the presence of just tons and tons of wealth. And so this guy definitely falls into that category. So Gehazi followed Naaman, and when Naaman saw someone running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him. And he said, "Is all well?" So he's like worried because this guy's chasing after the chariot. So he gets down to check, and he said, "Oh, all's well." And then he spins this lie. "My master," that's clearly a reference to Elisha, "has sent me to you, say to you," lie, "there have just now come to me from the hill country of Ephraim two young men of the sons of the prophets." Now, Ephraim is farther south in northern Israel than, say, Samaria is, or the Jezreel Valley. So these are out-of-towners. They've come on a fairly decent journey, I would guess. That's the way he's spinning it. They come as young men from the sons of the prophets, so they're part of our group. So he says, "Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothing." So give each one of them a change of clothing, which clothing was an item of value back at that time, and then a talent of silver to be split between them. Now, a talent of silver is about 75 pounds, and so we're talking some serious money here, and a couple of $100,000, I would guess. And Naaman said, "Oh, be pleased to accept two talents." He's like super, super generous. I mean, he came to give it all, and Elisha wouldn't take any of it. So he's like, "Wow, don't take just one talent, take two." So now we've got like 150 pounds of silver and two changes of clothing. He urged him, and then he tied up the two talents of silver in two bags with the two changes of clothing, and he laid them on two of his servants. So we're talking about some packs here. They're going to weigh, you know, probably with the silver and the clothing, each of these packs is going to weigh about, you know, 80 pounds or so. And so Gehazi can't carry that by himself. That's a lot. So two servants are dispatched to carry it back for him. So they carried them before Gehazi. And when he came to the hill, so this hill apparently is near wherever they're staying, he took them from their hand and put them in the house. So he basically says, you can stop here. Let me take that from you. And he takes one pack, takes it into the house, comes back out. I'll take that, takes the other pack, puts it in the house. And then he sends them on their way. So he put them these packs into the house, and then he sent the men away, and they departed. Then he went in, and he stood before his master. So he's trying to do all this covertly. He's trying to do all this surreptitiously to not let Elisha know that he had gone and got this stuff. And so Elisha talks to him when he finally does come into the house that he's in, and said to him, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" And he did exactly like all of us that were bad teenagers or bad elementary school students from time to time, when we get asked by our parents or a teacher, what are you doing? Nothing. Nope, not a thing. Well, he said, your servant went in. He didn't go anywhere. I didn't go anywhere. So he continues his lie. Verse 26, but Elisha said to him, "Did not my heart go when the man turned from his chariot to meet you?" So I was perfectly aware of what was happening. God was keeping me tuned in to what was happening with you. And then he asks him this rhetorical question. Was it a time to accept money, silver, or garments, olive orchards, or vineyards, or sheep and oxen, male servants and female servants? Now, of course, those latter things are nothing to do with what he accepted. Maybe God's Holy Spirit was tapping into the dreams of Gehazi, what he would do with some of this money, how he would buy some olive orchards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and have some servants that would work for him and run these things. And it would be, a life of leisure from here on out. Maybe that's what Elisha's responding to, is the heart of greed. Verse 27, now comes the curse. Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. So leprosy, the mark from God, is going to be placed on this man, and then will be placed from time to time on some of his bad descendants, all the way, I'm guessing, to the present time, if that line is still going on. I don't think every descendant was going to end up with this. I think it'll be the select ones that act in a way that's inappropriate, just like Gehazi did. And so the prophet writer tells us at this point, so he went out from his presence a leper like snow. Remember I told you what leprosy looks like, is it's a loss of skin pigmentation. It looks like your skin is super, super white. And it's also got a little transparent effect to it, because it's deeper than just surface level. So that's why he leaves with Naaman's leprosy. And the next time we hear from him, he will be in the king of Israel's court telling stories about the miraculous power of Elisha the prophet. Chapter number 6. Now, the sons of the prophets said to Elisha. Now, keep in mind, this is a collection of the stories of the miracles of Elisha the prophet. And so we don't have clear dates attached to these things, just knowing that they're happening in the probably 850s BC. So some of these students come to Elisha and they say, "See, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan and each of us get there a log, and let us make a place for us to dwell there." Now, Does that mean that he's now down at the Jericho School of the Prophets? Or is there another School of the Prophets somewhere else along the Jordan River Valley in northern Israel? I can't tell you for sure what the answer is to that. But where they're at, they want to build a building to give a little breathing space to all of the students and teachers that are involved in the School of the Prophets. So Elisha gives them permission. He says, go ahead and do a building. So one of them said, be pleased to go with your servants. And he answered, I'll go. So they're like, hey, would you like to just come down and be with us as we're doing some of the logging to get the buildings ready? And he goes, sure, I'll come. So he went with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. Now, the Jordan River is in the bottom of a very dry river valley. But right along the banks of the Jordan and along any tributaries that are coming down from other water sources on either side of it, you have a lot of growth of some of it's kind of scrubby, but others are fairly decent trees that are growing up within that moisture zone along the riverbed. And so that's where they're cutting these trees from. And it says that one of them was felling a log. So he's chopping away at this tree trunk. And lo and behold, his axe head fell into the water. Now, that can happen. I mean, the way that axe heads are attached to the axe handle, if you don't check it on a regular basis, it can get a little bit loose. And when you do one of those back swings, the head will just pop right off and go flying through the sky. In fact, I believe there's some sort of connection to a Jewish law that if that's the way somebody gets killed, then that's manslaughter. It's not murder because you didn't mean for this to happen. But you'd still be held liable because you should have checked the axe. You should have made sure that it was in good, usable shape. But anyway, back to the story here. You can picture it in your mind, it goes flying off into the Jordan River. The Jordan River is different widths at different times of the year, but it's pretty much very muddy all the time because it's a lot of sediment in it. And so it's going to be tough finding this, finding this axe head when it flew out there. They don't have access to metal detectors like we would if we lost an axe head in a river. So the guy cries out, oh, alas, my master, it was borrowed. So, oh no, this wasn't my own axe. It belongs to somebody else. I'm on the hook for money now. And so the man of God said, well, where did it fall? So he wants an approximation, where did it splash? So he showed him the place, and then he did something. Again, it's absolutely miraculous because this is not the way things work in the natural world. So he cut off a stick, and he threw it in there and made the iron float. So iron doesn't float, we know that. Throwing a stick on the water doesn't make iron float. So this is 100% miracle. He just uses some sort of symbolic activity, motion, in order to give an attachment point for faith. And so once it floats, Elisha said, well, take it in your hand. So he reached out his hand and he took it. And then I'm sure he either reattached it well or he made sure it got back to the person he borrowed it from, and that it was attached properly by that guy. Next story. And this is one of my favorites. I love this one. Once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, And again, we don't know exactly when this happened. We just know it's during the time of Elisha's ministry and presumably during the time of Jehoram, the king of northern Israel. So the king of Syria, the guy that Naaman works for, and Naaman may have actually been involved in some of these military maneuvers. He took counsel with his servants, saying, at such and such a place, that's going to be my camp. So they're doing their warfare planning, and they've got the idea of where they're going to set up shop. Verse number 9, but the man of God, this would be Elisha, sent word to the king of Israel, I think that's Jehoram, beware that you don't pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there. So watch out, don't get anywhere near this particular site, because the Syrians are camped out there. And then the king of Israel sent to that place about which the man of God told him, and thus he used to warn him so that he saved himself there more than once or twice. So Elisha is giving inside military intelligence to the king of northern Israel to keep him from being ambushed by the king of Syria and having his stuff taken. Verse 11, well, the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. It just kept happening. And he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel? All right, where's the leak? I want to know which one of you guys is on the side of Israel passing military information on to them. That's a reasonable assumption, isn't it? Now, one of his servants said, none, my lord, O king. None of us are doing this, but he does know how it's happening. He says, Elisha, the prophet who's in Israel, he tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. Elisha is a prophet. He knows exactly what's going on everywhere in your private moments. And he's passing that information on. So now Elisha has been identified as the security leak. Well, what do you do with security leaks? You plug them. And so he said, you go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him. And it was told him, well, behold, he's in Dothan, which is in the hill country outside of the city of Samaria. So he sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. So this is a major military operation launched to capture Elisha the prophet, to plug an intelligence leak. Now, when the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, now, I don't know if this is Gehazi, if it's an older story, like way back, or is it a new servant that's replaced Gehazi? We don't know. But his job is to get up earlier each morning and get everything ready for Elisha. You know, get breakfast taken care of and get the water and all of that. So he's out taking care of his early morning chores, and behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. So that's what's being talked about everywhere, is that the city's surrounded, and he can get up on the walls and he can see, oh my goodness, there's chariots everywhere. We're surrounded. And so the servant runs back to Elisha and he says, alas, my master, what are we supposed to do? So the city is under siege. We're all going to be taken as slaves. Verse 16, Elisha said back to him, don't be afraid. For those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Now, that comes off as a little bit vague at first until you read the next line. Then Elisha prayed and said, oh, he who is, please open his eyes that he may see. And so he who is opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So this is one of those few moments where God draws back the unseen veil, the veil between the physical world we live in and the unseen world that overlaps our own, a world that's populated by the angelic hosts. And suddenly, he sees what Elisha may have already seen on several occasions, is that God has a guard around Elisha to make sure that nothing untoward happens to him. And this is a good thing for all of us to recognize, is that God's angels are not seen very often. Very rarely do we have angel sightings. But they're there. Right now, the room I'm sitting in right now recording this at the studio, angels all around. Church buildings, when we're in them, angels around. Your houses, angels all around. When you're driving, when you're flying, when you're on the bus or you're playing sports or you're at work, angels are in attendance. They have been sent by God to see to the needs of those who will inherit salvation. That's Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14. That's their mission. And so this young man needed to know there's no need for panic. God has it. God's angels have it. Verse 18. Now, when the Syrians came down against him, so now they've surrounded the city, and now they're making their demands that the city surrender. So when they came down against him, Elisha prayed to He Who Is. Nice, simple prayer, very interesting. Please strike these people with blindness. So take away their sight, Lord. And so He, meaning God, struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. That's a pretty major miracle, isn't it? And then Elisha did this. He went out and said to them, "This is not the way. This is not the city. This is not where you're supposed to be if you're looking for Elisha. Follow me. I'll bring you to the man whom you seek," which is really funny, because he is the man they're looking for. And it's also funny and weird that these guys are not in a, and you'll have to pardon the pun, they're not in a blind panic about being struck blind. They are, all of them, sightless soldiers, and they're willing to, like, grab a hold of each other's shoulders with the lead guy, the commander, holding on to this prophet. They don't know it's a prophet, who's going to take them to the city where they can presumably arrest Elisha the prophet. Which, again, very strange. They're all sightless right now, and yet they still seem to think they can continue with their mission. And so what does he do? He leads them from Dothan over some hills and around some curves until he finally gets to Samaria. And as soon as they all entered in Samaria, you know, got into the place between the two gates. Most of the cities back at this time were double gated, with the area between being a security zone where you would be able to pin your invaders if they came through the first gate and you'd shut the second gate. Well, they're in this security zone, and that's when Elisha prays a second time. "Oh, He Who Is, open the eyes of these men that they may see." And so He Who Is opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. So now they are in, they're in the security zone of the capital city, and no doubt surrounded by a whole bunch of Israeli army people. As soon as the king of Israel saw them, so this, I believe, is Jehoram, he said to Elisha, "Abi, my father." So he's clearly developed some sort of ongoing relationship with Elisha the prophet. "Shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down? So should I kill all these guys? am I supposed to kill these soldiers? And his words back are very important to the idea of the laws of warfare. Warfare is not intended to annihilate everybody. It's intended to stop the aggressive action of the other side and resolve the issue. And so Elisha says, you're not going to strike them down. You're not going to kill all these guys. That would be a massacre. That would be a war crime, actually. Would you strike down those whom you've taken captive with your sword and with your bow? That's a rhetorical question, and the answer is no. Good soldiers don't murder people they've captured. They don't kill off the wounded of the other side. That's not the way it works. So instead, he says, set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. So turn them into POWs, feed them, take care of them, until the arrangements can be made for them to be returned back home according to the rules of warfare and also according to the ceasefire treaty that would have happened. And so King Jehoram does exactly that. He prepared for them a great feast. When they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And then probably because of the treaty that had to be followed up from this, the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. So for a period of time, they behaved themselves. They left Israel alone. They kept to the terms of the treaty, which had been brought about by the capture and return of their entire incursion force. We are pretty much out of time for today, but that brings us to the end of all of these miracles of Elisha that don't have times attached to them. Next time we get into God's Word, we're going to talk about a changeover in some of the administrations of the region before the next stories come to pass.